Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 23rd, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. Now, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And the way that I support the show to make sure that everybody can listen to it for free is through a few different things. You can go to my website, karasantamaria.com, and click through the links to the Talk Nerdy store. You can buy merch that supports the show. Obviously, I sell ads on the show. That's another good way to support it. But the main way, honestly, the bulk of the support comes from support. That's the word I keep using. Comes from the help of listeners like yourself. And I use Patreon because it makes things really easy, really streamlined. And I think it really is a good tool for you, the Talk Nerdy listeners. So if you go to www.patreon.com/talknerdy, you can see how to support the show. What you do is you pledge a certain amount per episode. You can also pledge for other shows per month, like The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, the other show I work on. And you set a limit, and then that limit gets divvied up. So it's really helpful. You'll never go over budget. And you get all sorts of perks, like me calling your name out on air. So let's go ahead and thank those of you who supported at the $25 or more level this week. And that includes Jeffrey Sewell, Brian Holden, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Jafe, The Honorable Husband, love that name every time, Jonathan Wright, Charles Payet, Jeffrey Perez, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, David J. E. Smith, The Zombie Drummer, oh yes you are, and last but not least, Phil T. Bear. Thank you guys for making Talk Nerdy possible. All right, this week is, I say it every week, but this week is an extra fun one. It's kind of a 20 questions, except like 1,000 questions, because I have a fascinating guest. Her name is Dr. Lauren Ayton, and she is an optometrist who did a PhD in pediatrics and then a postdoc in traumatic brain injury and eye movement. So she's incredibly knowledgeable about everything eye and brain and kiddos. She's now the director of clinical and regulatory affairs at Bionic Eye Technologies, a startup company in New York that commercializes research from Harvard, MIT, and Cornell. And we spend a long time in this episode talking about how the eye works and how technology can help improve it through the use of bionic vision. What? All right. This is a really fascinating episode. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Lauren Ayton. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's such a pleasure. I'm a huge fan. I'm very excited to chat with you today.
Oh, that's so sweet. So, of course, I detect an accent, but you are not actually connecting to me from across the great, great big pond, are you?
No.
By that, I mean from Australia. Where are you right now?
Yes, I'm a little bit closer than normal. So I'm actually living in Ithaca in upstate New York. So I've been here for about 6 months now, come across to work with some engineers at Cornell University and absolutely struggling with the cold. Absolutely freezing my butt off.
Yes, that would be such a transition from Australia. Where were you living when you were living in Australia?
So I was in Melbourne. So it wasn't, you know, as tropical as it can be up the top of Australia, but it's still a hell of a lot warmer than it is here. So it's, you know, it's almost May and it's still snowing outside. It's amazing.
Well, I won't tell you what I'm seeing out the window here in Los Angeles.
Don't cry.
Well, so you've had quite an interesting journey. So from what I've gathered, you're an optometrist, but you have a PhD. Do most optometrists have PhDs?
No, it's pretty rare, actually. So there's not that many of us that do it. So I think often when you finish optometry, you've been studying for so long that, you know, you kind of want to go out and work clinically. But I've always been interested in research. I've always wanted to, you know, answer a lot of those big looming questions. So it sort of was a natural progression for me.
Absolutely. So you've got you're an optometrist with a PhD in pediatrics, and then you did a postdoc in traumatic brain injury and eye movement. So were you interested in traumatic brain injury and how it affects, you know, the visual system in children, or are all those things a little bit disparate?
Yeah, so the particular project I was working on was really exciting, actually, because one of the biggest challenges in kids, if they've had a traumatic brain injury, you kind of don't want to put them through too many tests if you don't have to. So what we were looking at is whether you could use something as simple as what do their eyes do and what are their eye movements like to work out whether they're actually going to need extra interventions and extra monitoring over time. So it was quite a fun project. So we had a game basically that the kids were playing, and we did a whole lot of different, you know, obviously different sort of psychological tests and things as well. But looking to see whether or not that game and looking at how their eyes moved when they played the game could predict how they actually would recover. And we found it was pretty effective.
Really? And so is that for most types of TBI or just very specific ones that affect eye movement?
Yeah, so it was quite specific. So it was looking at sort of just mild TBIs, and we were looking at particular types of eye movements as well. So it's sort of definitely not something that you can generalize to a large population or to many different injuries. But yeah, in this particular cohort, it was something that, you know, could be used, I guess, a bit as a trigger. So, you know, if they fail this particular test, then, you know, you might want to give them a little bit of extra help as they recover.
And of course, that's a non-invasive, non-stressful way to test
exactly.
a child.
Exactly. And, you know, it was quite interesting with the recruitment, because we were recruiting from emergency departments and hospitals. And, you know, the last thing that they want to do, both the children and their parents, is talk to a researcher. You know, they had so much else going on. And so it was sort of nice that it was something that was quite fun for the kids and was non-invasive and quick to do. So we were lucky in that sort of respect.
Absolutely. That's fascinating. And so it really interests me when sort of the medical world and the research world collide. And now you're working in an area that really is in some ways an amalgamation of both of those things, because you're doing research, or actually clinical work with a very, very forward-thinking medical device.
No, it's an incredibly exciting. It's funny. I often when I'm at parties and people ask what I do, I'm like, well, we're basically making the $6 million man. And, you know, and then, you know, kind of show my age a little bit. But, but you know, it is pretty exciting. So we're working on a bionic eye device, which is a medical device to give back sight to people that are blind.
Okay. So I have 1,000 questions and we'll spend this entire podcast episode talking about it. So my background is neuroscience and psychology, but when I was studying both of those areas, I was really, really interested in the visual system because, of course, the retina, which is the part of the eye that ultimately really helps you see, it's kind of the part of the eye that's between all of the, I guess, physical structures and your brain is technically central nervous system, right? Like it's right there, it's right connected, and it's got neurons in it. So there's a lot of neuroscience that you have to learn when you learn about optics and optometry, even ophthalmology, even. But I was always really, really interested in the different ways that people can have blindness or low vision. So obviously blindness is not one disorder. People can have an injury to their eye. They can be born with all sorts of like retinopathy of prematurity or different issues that are congenital. They can have degenerative disease. Can you use a bionic eye for any of these different problems, or is it got some pretty specific applications?
Yeah, definitely. So it's an excellent question. So when you think about the visual pathway, you're completely right. There's so many places along that pathway that things can go wrong. So when you look at something, the light actually from that object comes in through the front of your eye, through the cornea. It's then refracted back to the back of the eye, to the retina. The retina has to translate that light into electrical signals, which are then sent via those neurons back to the optic nerve, goes back to the brain. So you think about that and how complex that system is, you can see, you know, why there's so many points where that can go wrong. The good thing is that in the bionic eye sphere, there's actually different parts along the visual pathway that you can put electrodes and implants to help people with vision loss from different causes. So the devices that I've worked on, both in Australia and here in the US, are both retinal implants. So the electrodes that we implant actually go into the eye itself. So it means that you have to have an eye still. So unfortunately, people that have lost an eye from trauma and things like that, that's not going to work. And it also means that the nerve has to still be intact between the eye and the brain. But there are other options. So there are some groups that are working on brain implants. So we can actually put electrodes directly into the visual cortex. or into different parts of the brain, so the lateral geniculate nucleus, for example, or the optic nerve itself can have implants too. So there's sort of a whole raft of options for different people.
Very cool. So let's maybe do a deep kind of slow dive and break down each of these different waypoints, and then we can focus on the retina, which is where your work is focused. So you mentioned that light, which we know is like a physical thing, even though it has no mass, it's very confusing, but light is, it may be a particle, it may be a wave, regardless, it's a photon. So it comes in this little packet. It's like, ooh, we've talked about physics a lot on the show. So it comes in a little packet and it's bouncing around out there. And really that's what vision is. Vision is perception of light, right?
So exactly.
That's bouncing around, and it eventually makes its way into your eyeball. And the way that it makes its way into your eyeball is, first it goes through, you mentioned, the cornea.
Yeah.
What's the cornea?
So cornea is basically, if you wear contact lenses, that's what you're putting your contact lens onto. So the cornea is a clear part. It's a curved part at the front of the eye. And it's an amazing structure because it's obviously clear and transparent, but things can go wrong, obviously, in the structure. And so you can actually get changes in the shape of the cornea, and it's something called keratoconus. And that can completely throw out what happens to the light when it comes in, and it then isn't focused correctly at the retina. So again, just another example of one of the things that can go wrong with the eye.
And this is long before it gets to, and we'll get there, but it's long before it even gets to the lens. It's still at the very surface level of your eye that you can just have a messed up shape situation, and then it's bending the light weird.
Exactly. And so that's sort of the, you know, the pathological problem with the cornea. But what's much more common, and people would have heard of more, is that they could have something called astigmatism. So astigmatism is something that you might need glasses for. So it's just a very, very common thing where the cornea is not perfectly spherical in shape. And so again, when the light comes in and is focused back towards the retina, those light waves just aren't hitting in parallel like they should be. So yeah, that's, if anyone ever goes to see an optometrist and they say they've got astigmatism, and people always freak out and think it's a stigmata, which I quite like. Not quite as interesting, but you know.
That's amazing.
The number of people I've had that have said to me, I've got a stigmata. I'm like, no.
No bloody qualms in here.
Not quite the same.
Hilarious. So yeah, I have a pretty bad astigmatism. It's much worse in one eye than the other. So even though my prescription is only like -1.5, my glasses aren't very strong. My astigmatism is brutal. So when I have to wear contacts, I hate it because they're the weird pointy ones, and you have to blink a lot to keep them in the right like orientation. They're like weighted. Yeah. I don't like them.
Yeah, no, they're very tricky. And I completely understand. And look, the other thing it makes really tricky too is laser surgery. So a lot of people will have heard that, you know, you can get laser eye surgery to correct what's called your refractive error. So we're talking about light coming in and focusing on the retina at the back. If your eye is too long or too short, that will affect the focal plane, and also astigmatism affects the focal plane. So you can do laser surgery, which changes the shape of the cornea. But the trick with astigmatism is, because it's only changing the curve on one angle, it's a lot harder to laser to treat that. You're not just flattening the whole cornea. You've got to do it just on one angle. So that is why I'm in complete awe of refractive surgeons.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's super, super specific and very, I guess you would say, bespoke surgery.
Definitely.
It's quite a tailored surgery.
It really is.
And so, okay, after light comes through the cornea, and again, let's maybe specify, because I think a lot of people know of like the pupil, they know of the iris, they know of the sclera, all of these things are just behind the cornea, but how are they all different?
Yeah, so the pupil is basically the black spot in the center. So it's actually a hole, and that's where the light goes through to be focused at the retina at the back. And the iris is the colored part of your eye. And the iris is amazing. So it's a muscle, it's actually made up of two different areas that constrict and dilate in different ways. And that's why when you go into a dark room, your pupil gets larger, because the iris muscle changes to let more light in. And then if you go into a bright situation, your pupil gets smaller again, because that iris muscle is changing its position.
And so the pupil is not really a thing. It's just a hole.
Just a hole. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So really, when we talk about your pupil getting bigger and smaller, it's that the muscles are actually making the hole within the iris bigger and smaller.
Exactly. Exactly. And so when you take a photo of someone and you get that red eye reflex, what you're actually getting is a reflex from the retina at the back of the eye, which is a pinky red sort of color, and you're seeing it through the hole of the pupil. So that's why you get that sort of red flashback.
And it's in some ways similar to certain animals that are more nocturnal, right? Because they have like a reflective situation in their retinas.
Yeah, that's right. So definitely, a lot of the nocturnal animals, cats, the one that jumped to mind, have what's called a tapetum. So it's a really highly reflective layer that's sort of behind the retina. And the idea with the tapetum is it bounces more light back. So it basically maximizes the light that they can get.
Oh, cool. And it also makes them look super creepy when you're driving in the woods.
Totally. It's the added bonus. So,
love it. So we're not quite to the retina yet. The sclera, the white part of your eye. That's just, why is it white? What's going on there?
Yeah, so basically just to do with it.
I'm like, 20 questions. I love this podcast.
That's great. It's great. No, so basically, look, the sclera is white basically just because of what it's made up of. But it's again, very, very cool tissue. It's really, really tough. So anyone that has, you know, hurt their eye will realize that. It's really easy to scratch the cornea at the front of your eye. It's, you know, easy to scratch the conjunctiva, which is, we haven't even talked about that. That's a whole other clear protein that goes on the front of the sclera. But the sclera itself is pretty tough, which is good because we want our eyeball to stay intact. So that helps.
Yeah. So conjunctiva, I assume, is what gets infected when you have conjunctivitis, aka pink eye.
Exactly. And the trick with conjunctivitis, which a lot of people don't realize, is you can have so many different causes of conjunctivitis. So we tend to kind of go straight away, oh, it's bacterial, you know, hit it with antibiotics, but you can have, you know, allergic conjunctivitis or viral or a whole different raft of options there too.
Oh, so because when we think of that that suffix itis, like bronchitis, conjunctivitis, really all that means is that it's like angry, right? It's inflamed.
Exactly.
It's not happy.
Exactly. That's exactly what it means. So it's an inflammation of the conjunctiva. And the tricky is often, you know, trying to work out what's actually caused that. So definitely. Yeah. And there's a whole heap of, you know, these kind of very strange and rare viruses that you can sometimes get that cause conjunctivitis. So, you know, it's definitely worth, if you've got a conjunctivitis that doesn't go away after a long time, getting it checked out because it could be something a little bit different.
Oh, fascinating. That must have been really like fun to learn about when you were doing all of your... Actually, another question now. What is the difference between optometry and ophthalmology?
Excellent question. It's slightly different in different countries. So, in Australia and US differs a little bit. The way I like to describe it is optometrists are kind of almost like a general practitioner for your eye. So very good, obviously, at checking to see whether you have any refractive error, so whether you need glasses or contact lenses. They'll always do a health check of your eyes as well to see if there's any eye conditions. And optometrists can treat some eye conditions, but if they need surgery or more intensive medical treatments, then you would get sent to see an ophthalmologist. So ophthalmologist is someone that's done their medical training as well as specializing in the eye.
I see. So an optometrist doesn't necessarily have an MD.
No. So in the US, an optometrist is an OD, so a doctor of optometry. But yeah, it is different. So they won't have done, for example, surgical training. Unless in some states in the US, you can, you know, do some additional training to do a refractive surgery, for example. But in general, you know, if you needed an eye operation, it would definitely be an ophthalmologist.
Interesting. Okay, cool. And that's maybe why sometimes people who are just going to get their glasses prescription renewed, they'll go to an optometrist. Mm-hmm. But somebody who has had cataracts or who has struggled with macular degeneration or something, they might have an ophthalmologist.
Exactly. And it's sort of one of these things. I mean, the professions really work together. And so, you know, often if you go to see an ophthalmologist for a chronic eye disease, they might say, okay, I want to see you every 2 years for a checkup, but go and see your optometrist in between, and they can, you know, monitor things and do imaging and different tests to make sure that things don't get worse too.
Oh, true. Because they'll still dilate your eyes and take the picture of your retina and all that good stuff.
Exactly. Yeah.
Very cool. Okay. So we've gotten through the very first layer.
And now we're done. We've run out of time.
Right? Oh, yeah. And you mentioned that the sclera is super, super strong. And It reminded me of a time when I first was working in psychology, I worked with a neuropsychologist who specialized at the time in Texas. It was called the Texas Commission for the Blind. I think it has a different name now, but he had contracts with the Texas Commission for the Blind. So a lot of people would come in for neuro issues because, of course, remember, as we were mentioning, that's a central nervous system by the time you get to the retina. And there's a lot of what they call comorbid, you know, dual occurring situations where it's like blindness or low vision and some sort of neurological issue, as obviously you have done a lot of research in. And so we would see people with all sorts of problems. And I remember one time seeing a child who had lost his eye because he had a penetrating eye injury. And once it penetrates far enough, and I guess you lose that fluid inside of your eye, there's not really a lot you can do, is there?
So it depends on what the cause of the penetrating eye injury is. One of the biggest risks actually is small metal flying particles. So if you're welding or something like that, and the reason they're so risky is they're really, really hot and they're really, really fast. So if you get a little speck of metal that flicks up into your eye, it can actually get straight through the cornea. So it basically kind of burns its way in. But then once it's in the eye, it can rust. And so that's often so that's often when you get really bad complications, because those sort of tiny, tiny particles can be really hard to get out of the eye. But if they're in there, they cause really big damage and, you know, obviously cell death and all sorts of problems there. And that you can often lose your eye.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's so interesting. And so this, I'm remembering that this was a younger child and he had had a bad bout of like vomiting and coughing, and he actually ruptured his eye that way from the pressure going too high. And I think he had had a penetrating eye injury from something else, like it was cut from something, and then he was very, very ill. And it like ripped his eye open. Not good. But they were saying that, you know, there's this fluid. There's two different, I guess, types of fluid in your eye. And once you get to the deeper fluid, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah. So there's the aqueous humor. It's true. So basically in front of the iris that we were talking about before, so in between the iris and the cornea is the aqueous humor. So that's sort of the front fluid. And it's a lot more watery, I guess. And then the vitreous humor is behind the iris. So it's between the iris and the retina. And that's more of a jelly consistency. And so aqueous humor is sort of replaced more often is sort of the short answer with that. So, you know, if you lose that, it's not as big a deal. But the vitreous humor in the back of the eye is actually, in young people, attached to the retina as well. So if that jelly sort of pulls away, quite often it will pull part of the retina with it as well. And then you can have obviously damage to the retina too.
Okay. And so that's another big problem, which I'm not sure if we're to the retina yet, but retinal detachment is something that you hear people have all the time. Oh, yeah, I got retinal detachment from, I don't know, jumping up and down too much, or maybe there's some.
I was going to say,
like that happens to people. There you go. Of course. It's a very Australian reference.
Yeah,
that's
it. Yeah, it's, I don't know if it's called the same thing here, but.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Oh, we totally stole it from you guys down under. So is that something that is more commonly, like when a retina detaches either completely or partially, is that more commonly from trauma, or are there disease states that can contribute to that?
Yeah, so I'm actually not sure of the actual statistics, but it can be either, basically. So one of the big problems is if people are very, very short-sighted. So if they're myopic, which basically means their eye is too long. So you know how we were talking before about, you know, needing glasses to correct for the fact that the light's not focused to the retina. So if you're highly myopic, it means your eye's very long. It means the retina's basically stretched at the back. And so it's more prone to getting holes and tears and things like that. And if you get a hole.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah. So I used to always caution my patients that were very highly myopic or short-sighted not to bungee jump, because, you know, if you've already got that kind of propensity to it, you don't really want to risk that. But it is probably, again, I'm not sure of the numbers, but it's probably more common with certain eye conditions. So you can get conditions that, you know, cause bleeding underneath the retina, for example, and that will often cause the retina to detach and come off.
It's very delicate, the structure, and really complex, isn't it?
The retina is just amazing. It's, you know, it's got so many different types of cells within. So there's five major layers in the retina of different cell types, but within those, there's, you know, so many different subclasses of cell. But the whole structure is like the thickness of a piece of tissue, and it's the delicateness of a wet piece of tissue. So when it's, someone's, you know, if someone's doing surgery on the retina, for example, it's amazing. It's a very, very fiddly tissue to work with and, you know, very delicate.
Wow. Yeah. I would not want to be, I would not want that responsibility. Yeah,
no, it must be, I think it's one of the most beautiful surgeries to watch though, because, you know, they're so fine with every single little movement. It has to be perfect. And yeah, I do. I love watching it. I'm always very glad that I'm not doing it, but I do love to watch it.
And so let's maybe spend quite a bit of time now on the retina itself, because the retina is really sort of the brains of the eyeball, if as it were. It's where like the magic really happens,
I
isn't it?
So. So most of my research is in the retina, so I'm a little biased, but it's the magic center for sure. Look, my favorite fact about the retina is that the cells that actually respond to the light that come into your eye are actually at the back of the retina. So the light has to go through all of the other connecting neurons and yeah, this bipolar cells and interneurons and all the rest before it actually gets to the light detecting cells at the back. So it makes absolutely no sense, but it's evolution for you.
Yep, yep. It's a little chaotic. It just kind of happens the way it's going to happen, and then adjusts accordingly. Yeah, it's. I remember that being kind of a description or a discussion that the retina feels a little bit backward.
Yeah, and if any of your listeners are interested, it's actually really interesting to look at the evolution of the eye. You can go back and sort of track it through history, and you know how we got from our ancestors that basically had just a flat eye, where the photosensitive cells were just in a single plane, and then it sort of developed into this curved structure, which is, you know, led to the eyeballs we have now.
And there are some animals who still have these sort of like eye spots that never needed to evolve anything more complicated. And really all they can see is the difference between dark and light.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And then there's, you know, animals that are, you know, have probably more, even more advanced retinas than we do. So, in the photoreceptors, so these are the cells that react to light, there's different subclasses that respond to different wavelengths of light. And so we talk about red, green, and blue photoreceptors because that's the peak of their detection levels. So some animals have, you know, a whole raft of different ones that, so that we believe they can see a whole lot of different colors that we can't.
Or that they can see farther away from our band, like into the infrared or into the ultraviolet.
Yeah, ultraviolet. Exactly. So it's amazing. Cool. I love the whole, you know, the idea behind color vision and all the color vision research going on is so fascinating because it comes back to that kind of theoretical question of, you know, is what I see as the color blue, is it the same as what you see as the color blue? You know, we know the same cells react, but do we actually perceive it the same? It's fascinating.
It absolutely is because, you know, there's the subjective and the objective component, right? Like, and the objective component is that the exact same cells are reacting and they're reacting to the exact same wavelength of light.
Yeah, that's right.
But the subjective component is that's very
exactly. That's it. Exactly. And, you know, and then there's obviously people that are colorblind. So they'll have one of those particular types of photoreceptors that react to different colors of light may not be functioning very well. And so that's when people can be, it's usually red-green color deficient. So they have trouble, you know, distinguishing between the color red and the color green, for example. And there's people that have no color vision at all because none of those cells are reacting.
Yeah. Oh, achromatopsia. Exactly. I remember that one. But it's so funny for people who have normal color vision and, you know, color blindness is more common in men, right?
Yeah,
like, absolutely.
More.
It's so hard for like somebody like myself with normal color vision. Like, I understand why somebody would be red, green, colorblind because those cones are, you know, like you said, they peak at red or green and they have a problem with those cones. Like, it makes sense on paper, but perceptually, to not be able to discriminate between red and green, which couldn't be more different, is so strange to me.
I actually had a patient who was colorblind, and he described it beautifully to me. He said, if you think about a tomato, and, you know, tomatoes start off as green on the bush, obviously, and they go through all the way through to that really bright red when they're ripe. He said, for me, tomatoes always look the same. Like, that whole spectrum just looks the same. I'm like, that's such a great way to describe it, because, you know, yeah, when you just think about red and green looking the same, it seems very, very odd.
It is. Yeah. And same thing. So the third thing that can go wrong, which is much more rare, is it red, blue, yellow, or red, green, yellow? Or is it, it's like red, green, yeah, and so, then so, blue, yellow?
Yeah, exactly. A blue, yellow type as well, which again is, yeah, much, much less common. So there's the two that are more common are called deuteranopia and protanopia. And so they're the sort of the red, green ones. And then there's, yeah, one third class, which is blue, yellow confusion. But most people.
Oh, I love those. I'm adding those words to my list. Deuteranopia. And what was the other one? Protanopia, because I always do. On my other podcast, on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, I do a word every week, and those are great words.
There's so many beautiful words in ophthalmology.
I love it. And of course, like you said, a lack of color vision altogether. I'm going to make a guess. It's either that is anybody actually missing their cones, or is it more happening in the brain?
So it can be to do with the cones. So you can just have basically malfunction of the cones themselves. And I'm just trying to think. Forgotten the name, but there's an island that Oliver Sacks wrote a book about.
Yes, Island of the Colorblind. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Such a great book.
Yeah. And so they all had a genetic defect which caused damage to the photoreceptor cells and changed basically the absorption patterns of those particular cell types.
So it can happen in the eye, but it can also, I also hear sometimes, I remember him writing maybe in A Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, or maybe in An Anthropologist in Mars, about a painter who had some sort of trauma and then couldn't see color. So that made me assume it was, or I'm sure it was explained, that it was a brain problem.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, I think it's been, like, I believe it's been quite well mapped, you know, which part of the visual cortex correlates with color. So yeah. You know, injury to that area would affect that.
Oh, cool. Okay, so we've been talking about cones for a while, so it's probably important to mention that cones are the cell types in the eye, or the retinal neural types at the back of the eye. Like you said, the one, it has to go through everything else until it gets there. The ones that perceive color, and then there's also the ones that perceive motion better. Is that a good way to put it? Or kind of dark light better?
Yeah, so the easiest way to think about them is really your day cells and night cells. So cone photoreceptors are what we use in light conditions. And that's obviously, you know, when you can pick up things like color and all the rest. And our rod photoreceptors actually kick in when you're in a dark situation. So there's a test, for example, called dark adaptation, where you actually, it's a horribly boring test, but you can get people to sit in a room and turn the lights off, and you can actually measure the activity of the photoreceptor cells. And the longer they sit in the dark, the less the cones work and the more the rods will kick in and start to work.
And of course, when you're sitting in a dark room, as your eyes adjust and as your cones, or I'm sorry, your rods start to, like you said, work a little bit better, there's an effect that happens, which is that your resolution goes down. Things are a little grainier.
Exactly. And the interesting thing too is there's a lot more rods than there are cones in the retina as well. And the cones tend to be sort of congregated towards the center of the back of the eye. So there's a spot called the macula, which is where your central vision comes from. And that's much higher proportion of cone photoreceptors. And then when you get out towards the edges, there's more rods.
So that would be why your kind of focused vision, like when you're looking at a single point space, maybe to read or to discriminate something small, is not as good in the dark because your cones are less active.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it also is the reason why there's certain eye diseases. So one that I work a lot with is called retinitis pigmentosa. Mm-hmm. And it's a condition where the rod photoreceptors are lost first. And so what people end up getting is this really characteristic tunnel vision, because they lose the vision at the outside first. Mm. They lose their night vision first because those rod photoreceptors are dying off. And then, you know, as the disease progresses, it will start to affect the cones as well. But it's, very, very much starts off with those rods.
You get tunnel vision in glaucoma too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So glaucoma is the other one where that can happen. It's a slightly different pattern, the way that it's lost. And so there's a very interesting test called a visual field test, which, again, is incredibly interesting for clinicians and researchers and really boring to do.
I took one of those ones. Yeah. I took one. It's like little things in your periphery that like squiggles that like slightly move, or pluses that like slightly move. And you're like, yeah, there's one. Yeah, there's one. And I failed it miserably. And and I had to come back. And then it turns out they were worried about glaucoma. And then it turns out that I had just been smoking a lot of weed back then. And they think that it actually affected the pressure in my eye.
Yeah, no, it can do. It's actually marijuana is actually a alternative treatment sometimes for glaucoma.
Not here in LA. That. In LA, it's a real treatment. Yeah.
That's it. So the really cool thing with a visual field test is you can have a look and see which part of the peripheral vision is being lost. And that can actually give you a bit of a clue as to whether it's something like glaucoma or something like retinitis pigmentosa or another type of disease.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, Blue Apron. And guys, for 6 weeks, from April 16th through May 21st, Blue Apron is teaming up with Airbnb to bring you the best home cooking from around the world. Each week, the menu is going to feature a recipe developed in collaboration with an Airbnb Experiences host, like Cece, a chef from Shanghai who makes incredible Kung Pao chicken, which is sticky, saucy, yummy brown chicken and vegetables. You know what Kung Pao chicken is. Guys, Blue Apron is awesome. They deliver fresh, pre-portioned ingredients, step-by-step recipes right to your door. All of them can be cooked in under 45 minutes. And the menu changes every week based on what's in season. It's super flexible. There are 12 new recipes each week, and you can pick 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what fits your schedule. I love it. I'm loving some of the new menu items that are out right now, like short rib burgers with a hoppy cheddar sauce on a pretzel bun, or seared steaks and thyme pan sauce with mashed potatoes, green beans, and crispy shallots. Yum, yum. So I don't know what you're waiting for. You can get your first 3 meals free when you check out this week's menu at blueapron.com/nerdy. Again, 3 free meals. You just got to go to blueapron.com/nerdy. All right, guys. Let's get back to the show. Okay, so we've got these rods and cones. They have different functions, but they work together beautifully so that we have really lovely vision. You mentioned that the cones are more packed in an area called the macula. I've always heard that the cones are more packed in an area called the fovea. What is the difference between the macula and the fovea?
So basically, the macula is just the larger area, and then the fovea is in the center. And then in the center of the fovea is called the foveola. And that's dead center in where your central vision is. So it's just a bullseye.
That's all we're talking
about. Exactly. And the reason we talk about the macula is many people will have heard of macular degeneration. So a lot of the changes that happen in something like macular degeneration are always in a particular region. And so that macular region is obviously of real interest to us.
And then within maybe the macula, maybe the fovea, within this area where your vision is more acute, there's actually a physical hole in your vision where there are no receptor cells, because that's where your optic nerve leaves your eye.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, at the foveola, the cells, all the photoreceptor cells, are sort of slightly moved to the side. So you get this little dip in the middle, and then all of the ganglion cells and the neurons from the photoreceptors, as they've moved up through the retina, they all move along to form the optic nerve. So the blind spot is where the optic nerve is. And exactly right, because it's because there's no photoreceptors in that spot, in that region.
Because that's where basically all the axons, the long skinny processes on these neurons, bundle together to make this nerve. It's so fascinating, though, that, again, this is like come on, evolution. This is how you can tell it is not guided. It's so fascinating that this blind spot would be like where your vision is the best and not like over on the side of your eye or something.
Yeah. It's actually really interesting. So there's certain, party tricks you can do to find where your blind spot is. And it's very interesting when you actually realize where it is and you're like, oh, that's actually quite useful. But obviously we've got two eyes. So our eyes will compensate and sort of meld over that blind spot, so it doesn't matter that we can't see there.
Yeah, and we also have really brilliant brains, so even if one of our eyes were closed, we would kind of fill that in anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the fascinating thing. Like you were saying at the start, you know, the eye is just an out pouch of the brain, really, and they work so well together. So it's quite amazing when you often look at what a retinal recording is doing and then what the brain is actually responding to. It's an amazing process.
Ugh. And so, of course, okay, we're going to get back to the retina because that's where the cool research that you're doing sort of exists. But when all these different points of light come in and the retina goes, I've accepted you, but now I need to make sense of you, it turns this physical signal into an electrical signal.
That's right. And so then the electrical signal then, so remember we're right at the back of the retina at the moment. And so behind the retina is a blood supply called the choroid, and then there's the sclera again. So we're right at the back. And then basically that electrical signal has to go back to the front of the retina. So it goes back through all of these different layers of cells and gets sort of translated as it goes through. So it's the visual processing really starts at that early stage of the pathway.
Oh, yeah, that's really cool. So even this is probably why, or one of the reasons why the phenomenon of cortical blindness is that people can have brain damage to their visual cortex, like pretty severe brain damage, and say that they can't see, but then they'll still do things like step off curbs appropriately or move around obstacles.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Oh, look, it's a fascinating phenomenon. I worked with a man for a while. We were doing some research with him. He was absolutely amazing. He was very altruistic and helped out with a lot of our work. But he had a really strange sort of, he basically had a stroke in a particular part of his brain, and he was basically blind most of the time, but every now and again he would get back full vision.
Whoa.
And it was so amazing and just had everyone completely perplexed. So, you know, he had all sorts of scans and tests done and all the rest, but it's just, you know, that particular part of his brain that was affected just meant that he had this very transient visual experience.
Whoa, that is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Very, you know, disorienting for him, the poor man. It's, you know, he didn't know when it was going to happen. So he would, you know, sometimes just be, you know, not expecting it and have a whole lot of vision come back at once. And it would always pass fairly quickly. But you do learn a lot from working with people like him.
I wonder if he even enjoyed those transient experiences or if they became kind of noisy after a certain amount of time.
That's what he said. And I think, you know, the thing is, if you don't have vision, you do tend to learn to use other skills a lot more. And then when you get vision, it can actually be a little bit, distracting and annoying. There was a gentleman called Mike May, who's very famous in our field, and he had some damage to the cornea. So he actually had a chemical burn and lost vision. Oof. And when he was a child, and then when he was an adult, he actually had his vision restored through a graft. So he had a corneal graft, and it allowed him to get some sight back. And his reports of what he saw are just so interesting, because there was this disconnect between his eye and his brain because his visual system hadn't developed throughout his childhood years. And so it's just a fascinating area.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, it used to be we thought that there was like a hard and fast critical period. Mm-hmm. Now we know that there are these more sensitive periods, but some things are still critical. But definitely if your brain does not grow up seeing certain types of inputs, it doesn't know what to do with them later on.
That's it. It's so interesting. And you know, you were just mentioning then about the critical period, and a lot of people will have heard of lazy eye. So it's technical term is amblyopia, and it's basically when one of your eyes doesn't respond as well to the other, and it's a whole lot of different causes, but often it's because one of your eyes has more refractive error than the other, so it might be a little bit too long or a bit too short, and the other eye gets more development And we used to always think, so when I went through my professional training, you know, we were told pretty much 8 years of age, after that you can't really do much treatment, because the treatment is you patch the good eye and you basically make that bad eye work harder again. And, you know, in the last 10 years, the research has just changed so much, and it's now suggesting that it is worth trying at later dates, so that that critical period is a lot more flexible than we thought it was.
That's good news.
It's very good news.
Yeah, it's very good news. That's super cool. And so, okay, after all of this information enters into your optic nerve, of course, you've got two optic nerves because you've got two eyes. Then weird stuff happens. They cross each other, sort of, but then they also continue on the same side. So you've got some things where your right eye sees the left visual field and blah, blah, blah. But then it all comes together. It flips it upside down. It makes it really processable. Eventually ends up in your brain. And then there's all these different levels of processing that happen there, right?
Yes,
I'm realizing we have to do the Cliff's Notes version of this part because I'm asking you too many questions. So I want to get back to the retina. So of course, you will not get a good grade on your exam if that's all you learn about the rest of the visual system.
And then the brain does stuff at the end.
And then the brain does stuff and it's amazing and complicated. But so back to the retina, which again, like, it's so cool that you mentioned, because this is central nervous system, some of what we think of as the heavy lifting that the brain might do, that that higher level processing is actually starting even at the level of the retina. A lot can go wrong. It can actually detach. It can be damaged. There's like we talked about, there are congenital problems, there are degenerative problems, and there are actual organic or like structural kind of damage problems. All these things can go wrong. So many things can go wrong. And so you've decided to focus on one way that maybe we can use science and technology to fix these things that have gone wrong. Tell me all about it. I want to know, how does this bionic eye, that is not really what most people think of when they think of a bionic eye, because it's not an eyeball.
No, that's it. Because I think that's the immediate thought is, you know, we're going to actually take someone's eye out and replace the whole thing. And that's not the case. So look, the idea behind a bionic eye is that we want to replace part of that visual pathway with electrodes. And so those electrodes can either be run with direct electrical stimulation, or they might be photodiodes. So we could actually use, you know, implants that react to light, kind of like what the photoreceptors do normally. So they're the main two
options.
So
when we talk about, we do this a lot, you know, on my show, and I think a lot of times in other kind of news outlets, where we use the word electrode. And we throw it around, right? I used to work with them all the time. I was actually in an electrophys lab. And I forget sometimes that like even something as commonly used in labs as electrodes might not translate for a lot of people. So what is an electrode?
Yeah, for sure. So the way that the device that we're working on here works is it's basically a implant that goes into the back of the eye, which has got iridium oxide material, and the is a camera on a pair of glasses that takes a picture of what the person's looking at. And so the signal from that picture is actually translated to an electrical signal via an external processing unit. And then the signal from that processing unit goes to these small electrodes at the back of the eye. So we're basically talking about little pieces of metal, which are implanted into the eye in this case.
So they're like little wires, almost. Like they're little things that receive information and then transmit information.
That's right. Yeah. So, and the idea with them is really this idea of taking a visual scene and turning it into a electrical signal. And then that signal is then sent from the back of the retina forward through the other connecting cells to eventually go down the optic nerve to the brain.
Because that's what these cells that are either damaged or missing, that's what they do.
Exactly.
And so you're just trying to replace them with something non-biological.
That's exactly
something
right.
Electrical.
That's it. Huh. And so the very cool thing with retinal prostheses or bionic eyes is you can actually put those metallic electrodes at different parts of the retina. So you can put them behind the retina so that it goes in the same spot as the cells that have been lost. Or you can actually put them directly onto the ganglion cells at the front of the retina. So there's, you know, and those different options have different pros and cons. but both ways will actually still give the electrical signal to the ganglion cells and the nerves that need to have that activity.
So how big are these implants? Are they like the size of a mini SD card? Are they smaller than that?
Yeah, so it varies depending on which device. So there are obviously lots of different devices around. But yeah, you're sort of looking around about the size of a dime or smaller.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the largest.
Okay. And then it is required that, A, you wear these special glasses, almost like Google glasses that have a camera on them, mm-hmm. and B, that you have some sort of pack that does the computational stuff, almost like your iPhone.
Yeah, so that's most of the devices. So the other option is these ones I briefly mentioned that have photodiodes. So there are some that are sort of trying to use the natural incident light that's around us rather than having to translate a video signal. The advantage with that, obviously, is that you don't have to wear a camera. But the nice thing with the camera-based systems is that you can actually change the video that you get. So say if you're looking at a particular scene, but you're really only interested in things that are close to you, you can filter that image so that things that are close to you are the things that you see with the bionic eye device.
Cool. So then it really does get into the $6 million man because we're not just trying to fix a problem, but we're actually in some ways improving.
That's it. So the vision processing was incredibly exciting because it does give you all of these different options. So there's groups all around the world that are working on these different algorithms to really highlight areas of interest so that you can look, for particular maybe dark colored objects in a light room, or maybe you're more interested in objects that are moving quickly. So there's all of these different modes that you can use on the bionic eye that can be used for different situations.
Okay, so I have to ask you kind of a random question mm-hmm. that probably not many people who are listening are thinking of, but maybe a handful of people are, and I'm glad I'm tapping into that. I recently covered a story for a television outlet about optogenetics, mm-hmm. and they were doing some interesting work with macular degeneration where these researchers were using a special fluorescent protein from jellyfish mm-hmm. that can actually perceive light. Mm-hmm. It's a protein that in the protein itself can perceive light. It knows when light has hit it. So what they were doing is injecting this into patients' eyes mm-hmm. so that the lost photoreceptors were sort of replaced with these special proteins that could receive light. And granted, it could only receive light in certain wavelengths. So they did still have to wear glasses mm-hmm. in order to change all the light or filter all the light into like a special red wavelength that they needed to be able to see it. How, I guess, not so much just how is that different, this idea of optogenetics, but like, what are the pros and the cons of doing it in a sort of biological way where you're sort of GMOing it up and you're like adding sort of proteins from a different kind of animal to improve this very human loss versus adding technology that was, invented and developed to sort of improve this human loss?
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's an excellent question. The short answer is I think that we're going to eventually end up using both. I think that there's real potential for these things to actually work together. So there are groups around the world that are looking at that, looking at using optogenetics in correlation with a device as well and bouncing both of those off together. One of the challenges at the moment with optogenetics, like you said, is really sort of getting the right amount of light and the right type of light to the cells. But it's an exciting premise, but it is still quite a way away from clinical trials, on a large scale.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what about the bionic work that you're doing mm-hmm. specifically with the retinal? Would you call it a prosthesis?
Yeah. So we,
I guess it's not.
Yeah. So we do talk about prosthesis. So the general term is vision prosthesis.
The
bionic eye obviously is the one that people hear more often. it sounds a bit catchier.
Got a little bit of a cooler ring to it. Yeah. So this prosthesis or this bionic eye, how close are you? Mm. People have had this, right? Like this isn't just a fantasy land. People walk around with bionic vision.
Exactly right. So I think the latest numbers are that it was up to about 300 people now around the world have had a bionic eye implant. So there's devices that have been regulatory approved. So the main one in the US is by a group called Second Sight that have got an epiretinal device. So it's one that goes onto the top of the retina. And so people can buy those devices now. And in, you know, parallel, there's about 25 groups around the world that are working on all different types of devices. So they go in different parts of the retina, they have different electronics, different ways of stimulation, and they're all obviously trying to find the best way to stimulate the retina.
And so the device that you're working on now, is it still in trial stages? Have you moved into trials? Do people have access to it? Or are you still like earlier in the research process?
We're still earlier. So that's part of the reason that I've come across. So in Australia, I was leading the clinical trial of the Australian device. So I've come across here because we're preparing to do the same over with this group that I'm working with called Bionic Eye Technologies in Ithaca. Mm-hmm. So the idea with this particular device is that it's a subretinal device. So it goes in behind the retina in the location where those cells should be. So we're trying to replace the function of those in their natural location. And the exciting thing with this device is that it has a lot more of those electrodes. So we're talking about increasing the resolution of the devices to try and, you know, optimize the patient's visual acuity at the end.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So again, I have so many questions, but the two ones that sure. I can't help, but like they're right at the forefront is A, how the hell do you get it in there? And B, B, what is the resolution currently for people who can just like buy one of these medical devices, which I can't imagine are very accessible. I can't imagine that they're not incredibly expensive. And also I don't know if their insurance is even going to cover them. You know, we have our problems here in the US with our medical system. But so you go through all this trouble, you get, you know, this surgery, which is probably pretty invasive. You get one of the ones that is FDA approved that people have now that's not experimental. And how much better can they actually see? Is it just like they have blurry vision now, or can they read?
So, well, I'll answer your first question first. So the surgery itself is actually surprisingly, I won't say easy, but for a skilled retinal surgeon, the device is actually going very well. So depending on where in the retina the device needs to go, the idea is you need to make a little cut into the sclera and in the side of the eye, and you make a little pocket to basically put the device into. So it uses sort of, you know, very well established surgical techniques, and you know, that has been probably one of the easiest things for the field to accomplish, I think.
Wait, so you put it in the side of the eye, and then do you like push it down into the back, or do you actually get behind the eye and make the incision there?
No. So you actually, the incisions are all done sort of closer to the front of the eye, and then most of the devices around the world will then have some sort of a surgical glide or some sort of insertion tool which will allow that device to slide into place.
Oh, that's amazing. So I guess there's kind of leeway, there's space once you get down under the sclera to just move things around.
That's it. And there's, you know, certain materials that we can use to put into the space to sort of help to open it up short term to sort of help things to slide into place as well. And that obviously helps that process.
Neato. Okay. So cool. Okay. Not as, it's still invasive, but it's not like brain surgery. It's not like, cracking ribs or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. Which is good.
Okay. So we get it in there. And then, I'm sure there's a recovery period. There's a period where you have to kind of relearn. Well, I guess you don't really have to learn to see, but like get used to the new improved vision.
Yeah.
And then how improved is it really?
Yeah, sure. So at the moment, the easiest way to describe it is that the people that normally get these implants have what we call bare light perception. And so the best way to think about it is if you close your eyes, that's pretty much our starting point. So it means you can't see any objects. You can't obviously see faces or read or anything. But if there's a really bright light in the room, you might be able to see where that is.
Oh, okay. So bare light perception means you can kind of tell the difference between when you're standing outside in the sun or when you're indoors at night.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so from that level, most of the devices that are available now give people the ability to find, for example, a doorway or an object on the table, or be able to navigate with a little bit more confidence, just by getting some large visual cues. The trick, obviously, is we want to keep increasing the resolution of the device. And one of the ways to do that is to put more electrodes onto the implants that go in the eye. So the one that's available commercially in the US at the moment has 60 electrodes. We're now developing in the pipeline ones that have hundreds of electrodes. And it's thought that we'll probably need to get up to around about 1,000 electrodes to really start to get to the level where, you know, you can get fine detail. And, you know, what people that we work with say that they want is to be able to see people's faces and to be able to read. So that's what we're working towards, but we're not there yet.
So how many actual, let's say, cones, let's pick just one cell type. Sorry, this is like you're taking a quiz. It's totally fine if you don't know the answer off the top of your head. I can Google it. But like, are we talking that people usually have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or like millions of cones in their eyes? Millions. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And so is there sort of with the electrodes a one-to-one correlation? Like the electrode is a stand-in for a single cone, or is it really a stand-in for a cluster of cells?
Look, that's an excellent question, because one of the tricks is, so yeah, when we say millions, I'm really worried I'm getting this wrong now, but I think it's around about four. So say around about 4.5 million cone cells and about 90 million, I think, rod cells. So we're huge numbers. You think about it. So even though these implants are very small, the size of one of these electrode pads is still a lot larger than those tiny, tiny cells. And so what happens is when you stimulate an electrode, it actually stimulates a whole lot of cells. And one of the tricks at the moment, and what a lot of researchers are working on, is there a way that we can be clever about how we stimulate those and try and, you know, select what type of cells we might be able to turn on? So it's
right, because right now it's all or nothing.
Exactly.
It's rods and cones, mm-hmm. or whatever. And there's definitely no, I only want the red cones or I only want the green cones.
That's it, exactly. And the trick is too, so with the ganglion cells, the cells that are at the front of the retina that sort of take the message to the optic nerve, some of them are what's called on cells and some of them are off cells. So if you're just sending a huge bit of signal, they could be kind of cancelling each other out. So it's really going to be an area of huge development in the next decade or so to try and, you know, selectively target what we can actually stimulate.
Wow, that's so interesting. So obviously, it just like most of science, definitely the type of science that is moving so quickly in medical device research, especially with startup companies, we've come so far, but we could still iterate to come so much farther.
Yeah, yeah. Look, this is why it's so exciting, I think. You know, I've been incredibly lucky because I've got to work with people that have got these implants and, you know, hear what their experience is and what they're excited about too. And, you know, so part of the reason that I came to the US is I really saw the potential here that this particular device, you know, has potentials that we might be able to solve some of these problems for people. And that's pretty exciting.
So this company, Bionic Eye Technologies, where you are the director of clinical and regulatory affairs, you guys work with maybe both basic research and applied research coming out of Harvard, MIT, and Cornell.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the best of the best.
It really is. It's when I go to meetings and you just sort of pinch yourself and go, am I really sitting here? amazing. But look, it's one of the things I love the most about my job. So I'm a clinician. So my first ever day on the job when I started in this field in Australia, we actually had an engineering meeting and I sat there and I think I filled a notebook with just words that I didn't know what they meant. I was like, what is that? So from there, you know, these teams are so multidisciplinary that you have to learn to communicate as a team and you have to be able to work through those sort of professional differences. And that's really the strength of the Bionic Eye field. It's something where, you know, exactly your basic scientists, your computer scientists, the engineers, the microfabrication men, you know, and women, you know, they're all working together with the clinicians to get a device to patients.
Oh, that's so incredible. What an exciting field to be in too, because I really think we're at a place right now where a lot of these newer approaches to solving medical problems are kind of turning the way we used to do things on its ear. And you've got these startup companies, you've got these, you know, Silicon Valley types, or these people who maybe are coming from aerospace or are coming from, you know, a lot of different areas. And what's the word that they're disrupting? Yeah. Oh, I hate that word. But yes, I'm sure you have to use that in a lot of meetings, but like this very disruptive technology. But it really is. You know, there's a reason that it's called that when it actually is a disruptive technology, not just a new toaster.
Yeah, that's it. Well, and I think that there's like that. I think one of the really exciting things as well in this, and it's definitely in this field in particular. So our company was founded by a gentleman called Dr. Joe Rizzo, who's at Harvard, and he's a neuro-ophthalmologist. So he's actually trained as a neurologist and an ophthalmologist. So coming back to that idea of, you know, the brain and the eye being so intertwined. But the reason that he started this entire project was because of the patients that he was seeing. And this is really one of the things that's really strong in this area, is everyone, you know, is seeing patients that have these vision problems. And that is very, very, you know, encouraging and motivational for all of our people to realize what we're trying to build.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. What a cool job that you get to do every day, and what a great kind of service that you're really doing to so many people. Because you know what, visual problems are really common, like especially as we get older.
Yeah, that's true, exactly. And I think it's an interesting area with vision problems, because the two most common causes of vision problems are actually really easy to treat. So it's refractive problems, so needing to wear glasses or contact lenses, or cataracts. Mm. And cataract surgery is when the lens in the eye, which I think we bypassed, but the lens.
Oh, whoops. Oh yeah, that's a really important thing in the middle of the eye.
Don't ask that on the quiz.
That's like the thing that we've modeled all of our cameras in our, oh my gosh,
I just really skipped it. But anyway, so the lens basically focuses the light, is the short story with that. And but the lens can become discolored with age, and that's when cataracts come in. So cataracts are relatively easy to treat as well. It's a cataract surgery procedure. But from then on down, the common eye diseases that affect us, we just don't have good treatments for so many of them still. And so people do end up, unfortunately, losing vision or being born without vision. And so there's definitely, you know, a lot of people that can be helped by these sort of vision restoration treatments.
Absolutely. Oh, man. It's just so, there's so much. I highly recommend it. This is a weird recommendation that I'm about to make to everybody listening. But if you look at the eye and you're like, that's so confusing, but it's so fascinating and I want to learn more, I don't recommend you go like take a woodland creature and do this in your garage. But if you've ever had the opportunity, you know, thinking back to high school when maybe you weren't paying as close of attention, or maybe you were lucky enough in college to actually do a dissection of an eye, maybe there's a way that you can audit a class at your local community college or something. But it really is interesting when you get to actually hold an eye in your hand. You know, lots of times I think they use eyes from sheep or from cows that are already probably donated because of our food industry, because most people don't eat the eyes. And being able to like cut the lens out of the eye and feel it in your hand, feel that little hard nodule and look at it from all these different angles. I mean, I don't know. It was really something that captured my imagination and made me want to learn more early on. And I don't know if you had the same experience, did you?
I definitely did. And so the reason I got into this field is my brother, we were talking before about lazy eyes. So my brother had a lazy eye, and I remember, so he was one of the lucky ones where the treatment was really effective. So he wore glasses as a child and had a patch on his eye, and it meant that the eye that wasn't performing as well got back to normal vision. And I still remember, you know, being a young child and going along with him to the optometrist and just watching that his vision would just increase. And all he was doing was wearing a patch on the other eye, and just thinking about the magic that must be happening, you know, to be able to have a change like that.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, the structural integrity of an eye and all the features are amazing to have a look at. If you ever get the opportunity, I would agree with Kara. It's great.
I know it sounds a little weird and morbid, but like, trust me, it's such an important experience.
Yeah.
Well, Lauren, this has been absolutely fascinating. I would feel really guilty to keep you much longer, but Every episode I do end the same way. And I was hoping I could close out by asking you the same two questions that I ask all my guests.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So when you're thinking about the future in whatever context that's relevant to you, it could be the incredible work you're doing. It could be personal, or it could be, you know, more big picture stuff. We would all love to know, number one, what is the thing that you're most concerned about? The thing that keeps you up the most at night that really does kind of worry you, you know, maybe a darker answer there. And then number two, what are you really hopeful for? And what do you honestly feel like there's just a lot to be optimistic about?
So I think, I mean, I'm going to have to be stereotypical with the darkest one. So look, for me, it is climate change. You know, it's the changes that we're sort of doing to our environment with what we are doing as humans. That's probably the one that keeps me up at night, but I'm sure all of your guests probably say the same.
But it's, I mean, for good reason, because, you know, we've been talking this whole time about a system. We, you know, systems, I think, it's an important word, and it's a word that we don't maybe discuss enough. And there are so many different systems, and we're talking about tapping into the visual system to try to make improvements. There are ways that we can tap into our nutritional system or our organ system to try and improve ourselves. But ultimately, we really are at the mercy of the systems that are much bigger than us. And we're wrecking a system that maybe there's nothing we can do to our own bodies to mitigate, or at least not fast enough. So we have to change what we're doing to the environment, because we're in a closed system here on the globe.
Yeah, for sure. That's a perfect way to put it. Exactly what I think.
Ugh. Yeah. And it's so, I mean, I'm glad that it is a refrain that's echoed a lot on my show, because I feel like you really can't say it enough, especially considering that there are people out there who refuse to hear it.
That's it. And I think that's been very interesting for me, coming obviously from a different country and, you know, listening to some of the debates in politics and things. And you go, yeah, it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. But yes.
You are so diplomatic in your response. You're like, oh yes, it's very interesting. I might use a different word, but yes.
But
okay, so what are you looking forward to? What are you excited about?
So many things, actually, but I'm gonna keep it to the work sphere. I'm incredibly excited about how clinical medicine is interacting so well with science now. You know, and again, from when I started my career about 15 years ago, it is so different now. You know, you look at these places and hospitals are built up with research institutes inside the building. And, you know, the engineers that I work with all the time are also, a lot of them, you know, will work with other people on different projects, but it's got clinical involvement. And I think this is so exciting for what it means for people that have different conditions. I find that incredibly exciting.
Absolutely. Well, I'm so glad that you, A, are a part of that, and B, that you could spare a little bit of time away from your super important work to share these incredible innovations with me and with my audience. Thank you so much for joining me today. It was fascinating.
Oh, thank you. It's been so much fun.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you guys for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.